Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Look around for me, would you? Tally up all the various bits and pieces of globalization that you can see. Your car, that phone in your pocket, some of the jobs from today's jobs report for sure. Now, while you're thinking about that, think about this. Two little words, trade and war. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 6th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Well, here we are. I mean, we all knew things were heading this way, right? But now it has actually happened. We find ourselves on this Friday officially at odds with our biggest trading partner and most of the rest of the world's 10 or so biggest economies. And it's happening, this trade war, at a time when, by a whole lot of indications, by which I mostly mean today's jobs report, the economy is doing pretty well. So, on with it. Here to wrap up the last 5 days, four, really, if you had Wednesday off, are Anna Swanson. She's from the New York Times. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lynette, let me start with you. Yay, 213,000 new jobs. Unemployment rate is up a little bit, but that's kind of a technicality. Boo wages, right? Still stuck?
Still stuck. And, you know, this is part of the story that we've been seeing for a long time. You know, employers are starting to complain that they might have to give people more money, but that hasn't quite started yet. And this is a mystery that everyone will continue to debate about. And it's something that, you know, is probably not going to be helped by a trade war.
Well,
you know?
So, sorry. Go ahead.
I mean, most of what we're dealing with now, the trade actions that the Trump administration has put in place since this morning mostly have to deal with inputs. So things that companies use to make the things that you buy,
right. That
is going to hurt companies. It's going to hurt consumers. If you like Chick-fil-A, then the pressure cookers at Chick-fil-A are going to cost more money. So your sandwich will probably eventually cost more money. And we haven't really started to see this play out yet. But once we do, the American people will be able to decide whether they want to see more.
Right. Well, so Anna, that's kind of my question, right? There's been a whole lot of anecdotal data about some prices going up, right? Steel prices have gone up, aluminum prices are going to go up, but the headline data in this economy, right? The jobs number, the GDP growth, all that stuff is still good. How long do you figure, as a person who covers international trade, how long is it going to take to trickle down, if I could coin a phrase?
Yeah, well, it certainly takes a little bit of a while, and this strong jobs report that we had today is certainly masking some of that effect, I think. Other effects haven't really yet taken action, and
right.
We're going to, you know, maybe see a few months before we really start to see that in some of the prices. I mean, overall, economists are saying that actually the effect of the trade war on the economy is pretty small, maybe a few percentage points of GDP. But you can still experience a lot of pain without something that knocks you into a recession, right? So there are isolated communities. There are lots of communities in the United States that are going to be feeling the pain from this. You know, specifically with those tariffs targeting inputs, a lot of small and medium-sized manufacturers and a lot of farmers, both of whom are really important groups of support for the president.
Yeah. And Lynette, we should say here, you know, $34 billion in tariffs against a $19 trillion economy is not a whole lot. But I want to ask you about not how it ends, because we've got a piece coming from Sabri Benishour in about 3.5 minutes on what that's going to look like and what it might take. But the language here from both sides does seem to imply that they are in this for the long haul, the Chinese and the president.
Right. That's a key point. This is just at the beginning, and it doesn't look like either side is willing to back down. The Trump administration is asking for fundamental changes from the Chinese for their economy. And the Chinese are saying, no, we need these things that you want for our future. There's absolutely no way we're changing them. This trade war is actually coming at a time when the Chinese economy is doing the exact opposite of our economy.
Right.
It's not looking great. Usually what Wall Street has become used to is seeing that in the beginning of the year, the Chinese economy starts to hit the skids and the growth numbers start to reverse. And then the Chinese government has to help its economy in order to sustain growth. We did not see that this year. But actually, we saw that slowdown, that kind of hit the brakes moment just last month, at the end. So China's economy is actually in a precarious position. That said, the Chinese government can do whatever it wants.
Yeah, in essence.
You know, it can prop up its banks.
Right.
It can help certain industries. It can, you know, move the pieces around on the chessboard in a way that the U.S. economy cannot. The U.S. government cannot. So that has, you know, anybody calling this match scratching their heads because perhaps in the early rounds, the Chinese government can go in and support the companies and industries that are getting knocked by American tariffs. But later in the cycle,
it's a little tricky.
We don't know.
It's a little tricky, yeah.
We don't know.
Anna, let me ask you this, because people have asked me, and I've given the standard answer of, well, they want free and fair trade. But what does the White House want out of this trade war?
That's a great question. So the Trump administration has described this as kind of a negotiating bid that will force China and the other countries that it's dealing with into capitulation. But right now, we're just not seeing any signs that there are apparent negotiations with the Chinese scheduled. So, you know, one big question is whether this is really a negotiating tactic. And then, as you're kind of alluding, there are a lot of different goals in the Trump administration. A lot of different advisors have different opinions. And they're I think, trying to play to those, but then also respect the president's really intense focus on the trade deficit to do something about that. So we really have a slew of negotiating objectives here that have kind of bewildered the Chinese from what we're hearing.
And some of the rest of us, too. Anna Swanson at the New York Times and Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. Thanks, you too.
Thank you.
All right, have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, traders took a look at that now official trade war and saw really only this morning's jobs numbers, because stock trading is about nothing if not about looking for short-term rewards. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, we're going to dig a little deeper here for a couple of minutes on both jobs and the whole what with global trade thing, because there is some stuff to dig into. Trade war first, I think, and this thought. Without straining the metaphor too far, when there's an actual war, there is usually supposed to be an exit strategy, right? How do you win, and then how do you recover? What about with trade wars? How are we going to get out of this one and then get things back to normal? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
Normally, trade conflicts between countries start slow and build.
Don't just jump right to tariff retaliation.
Rufus Yerxa is head of the National Foreign and Trade Council. He used to be deputy director of the WTO, and before that, deputy U.S. trade representative. He says when he had to negotiate with other countries, exit strategies would be there all along the way before tariffs were ever imposed.
We always used to say in the past, if you got to the point of actually having to impose the measures, you know, you've already sort of lost the fight, because it's much harder at that point to get to a deal.
With China, he says, the administration went right to tariffs. China, of course, responded with tariffs, and in such a public showdown, it's much harder politically for either side to back down. Ryan Haas is an analyst at the Brookings Institution.
There is not yet a clear exit strategy.
Nor is there a channel, he says, to work things out.
The Americans haven't identified clearly what objectives they're pursuing, and there is not a mechanism built into the relationship that allows both sides to negotiate those objectives.
Both China and the U.S., Haas says, overestimated their leverage and are waiting to see who blinks first.
Both sides appear to be entering into a period of testing each other's political pain tolerance, and there is not a pathway out at the moment.
The problem, of course, with testing pain tolerance is the pain part. Prices will rise, customers will find other suppliers, investment flows will dry up, supply chains will reroute. Again, Rufus Yerxa with the National Foreign Trade Council.
This is not something where, you know, both sides suddenly say, okay, we've got a deal and everything returns to normal.
The longer the world's two largest economies play chicken, the harder it becomes to undo the damage. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, now jobs and that whole thing with the unemployment rate that I was talking about, that it went up last month to 4%, but for the paradoxically good reason that more people entered the labor force, started looking for work, in other words. Over the past year, almost 2 million people have put themselves out there, people who'd been discouraged by the post-recession economy or who'd maybe decided to get more education. So we sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman out this morning to see what is getting them back in the job market again.
Steve Rodriguez is 32. He lives in Los Angeles, and he's about to start a new job on Monday, patient admissions at a hospital. He's worked in a pharmaceutical lab, driven for Uber. He was injured and couldn't work for several months. Earlier this year, he started looking again.
To go through firewalls of online applications, no one calling you back. It's just, it becomes so disheartening after a while.
Then someone he knew said the hospital where he worked was looking for people.
And so now, you know, when a friend reaches out and says, hey, are you looking for a job? You jump on it.
It pays just above minimum wage, less than he was making before. Keith Reynolds was working in advertising technology until late last year. Then a 1-2 punch.
On the 1st of December, I was laid off and I told my wife. She said, don't worry, it'll be all right. And then the next Friday, she told me I have a little bit of cancer. And I told her, I said, you know what, we're going to figure this out.
Reynolds took time off to help his wife through chemo. He says she's doing well. He's started applying for jobs and gotten some interviews, but no offers yet. Kate Connors, 32, she taught for 7 years and graduated with a master's in public policy from Georgetown in May.
I thought magically I would have a job ready, but I found myself struggling. I applied to 50 places, created a spreadsheet.
She landed a good job in the end, but she says job searching's not easy, even with a strong economy and low unemployment. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Mate, when you put it in your mouth, you would pay double that for it. It's such a delicious piece of steak.
No, but I mean, it's really expensive, y'all. First, though, let's do these numbers. These numbers? What is that, do these numbers? Let's do the numbers, guy. Dow Industrials gained 0.4%, 99 points, 24,456. NASDAQ climbed 1.3%, 101.76, 88. The S&P 500 rose 0.8%, 23 points, 27.59. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow gained 0.7%. NASDAQ climbed about 2.5%, 2.4% technically. S&P 500 tacked on 1.5% today. Bond prices, well, they rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.82%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Not everybody gets a chance to learn about the economy in school. Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that's smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy, and that is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Just because you can't say it often enough, this is a global economy. We only live in it. Education division at the moment. Nearly a third of the foreign students studying in the United States are Chinese. And in the process of paying for school and just living, those 350,000 or so people spend billions of dollars here. What with the trade war and all, though, and a focus by the Trump administration on intellectual property theft and forced technology transfer, things for Chinese students might be changing. Our China correspondent Jennifer Peck has more now from Shanghai.
Dong Huaihao has a chemical engineering degree from Tianjin University, a good school near the capital of Beijing. It's no small feat. Colleges limit the number of students they take from each province. For every 10,000 students who took the national entrance exam in Henan province in 2014, only 3 were accepted into Tianjin University. Dong Huaihao was one of them. Now he wants a bigger challenge, a graduate degree from the U.S.
American universities are better than China's. They usually have a long history, their libraries are big, and their learning facilities are more sophisticated. Americans are good at critical thinking, which is very different from our culture.
For the past 3 years, he has been taking U.S. test preparation courses and hired an agency to help him navigate the American admissions process. So even before he's accepted into a university, Dong Huaihao's parents have spent more than $7,500, which in Henan province is the average wage for an entire year. The investment paid off. Dong Huaihao is attending the University of Southern California in the fall to pursue a master's degree in chemical engineering. He says news of stricter rules in the U.S. didn't stop him from applying for a visa back in May.
I had to prepare a lot of documents, like proof of my parents' income and assets, but the officials at the U.S. Embassy barely looked at them. They asked me a couple of questions and then said I have to undergo an additional checking process.
He's heard of classmates who are in the same boat. The Deputy Assistant Secretary for Visa Services from the U.S. State Department, Edward Ramatowski, told a Senate subcommittee hearing in early June that Chinese citizens in sensitive fields may be limited to a one-year visa in an effort to prevent intellectual property theft. Professor Zhao Huajun from Zhejiang Chinese Medical University says it isn't fair to students.
When Chinese students study abroad, they learn foreign technologies through recognized academic programs and exchanges. They are not there to steal or hurt America's national interest.
In 2013, U.S. authorities charged Professor Zhao Huajun with economic espionage when he was working as a researcher at the Medical College of Wisconsin. That was later dropped when he pled guilty to a lesser charge of illegally downloading data, which he maintains was an act to safeguard the research. At a conference room in Shanghai, a dozen parents gather at an information session held by the education consultancy group Focus International. Among the first questions was how to prepare for a campus tour. But visa problems are also at the top of their minds these days, says General Manager Michael Yan. He says the U.S. has been tightening visa rules for the past 5 years. Despite that, he sees a growing appetite among Chinese families for an American education. His clients are not just sending their children to American colleges, but also to junior high and high schools.
One of the reasons parents send their kids to study in the U.S. earlier is because they hope that this will give their child an edge with American colleges later.
A big reason people want a U.S. degree? It's valuable in the China job market, says college student Teng Feixue.
There are too many Chinese students with graduate degrees from top universities in China, so I want a degree from a famous American college to stand out in the job market.
Recently, she got a visa to study for a master's degree in chemical engineering at Columbia University. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
I went out to Hollywood a couple of weeks ago, late-ish in the afternoon, to go to a butcher shop. Basically, it's a butcher shop, but it's a butcher shop attached to a really high-end restaurant. It's the latest venture from Australian celebrity chef Curtis Stone. You might know him from Top Chef Masters, among other things. The place is called Gwen. He runs it with his brother Luke.
He's my older brother, so he's the boss, of course. And, he runs the front of house, and I guess I run the back.
Yeah, something like that. That's how it's supposed to work anyway.
Tell me about this place.
So it's a meat-centric restaurant.
Meat-centric?
Meat-centric.
That's awesome. That's my favorite kind of place.
It's funny, you know, we don't call it a steakhouse because it's not a steakhouse, but it's kind of like a steakhouse, if you know what I mean. It's a butcher shop first and foremost. So as soon as you walk through the front door, you find a big butcher's counter. The butcher shop sort of services the restaurant, and the restaurant services the butcher shop a little bit.
We got there just as prep for dinner service was picking up. Things were getting busy. But I did manage to get a taste or two.
See, this is the important stuff here.
Yeah, yeah.
So this salami we make with leek ash and porcini mushroom.
I'm going to sound like an idiot. What's leek ash?
Well, you burn leeks in the charcoal burnt oven, the charcoal burning oven, and you cook it down until it's an ash.
Yeah.
You then use those ashes with the pork on the porcini powder. Not bad, right?
Oh, man. Hmm. Oh, yeah, and then the finish is really good? Yeah.
Everything that we make, we set out to make it as delicious as that. You know, every single thing.
I was going to ask you what happens when you get it wrong, but when you get it wrong, it never sees the light of day.
That's what my family eats. The mistakes.
Yours too, Luke.
The Stone Brothers opened Gwen back in 2016, which puts them right at the point of maximum risk because a lot of new restaurants that do wind up closing shut down in their first couple of years.
So after we had the leek ash salami, we had the how's business going conversation.
Who's your clientele for this place, right? This is 80-something seats. Who do you want in the door?
We want people to come in here that love good food. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, we have a premium product, you know, in terms of the butcher shop. We take real care in both the sourcing, the aging, the butchering of the meat. And then we treat it pretty carefully over a fire. But it's also just a piece of meat on a fire. You know, we don't take it too seriously and we have fun.
When Curtis and I started talking about it, he came up with this idea of opening a butcher shop in the restaurant, which we're quite familiar back home in Australia. Yeah. But then there's not too many of them in LA, so people think we're a little bit crazy doing it here. But it really, as Curtis was saying before, does form the heartbeat of the restaurant and
okay,
is
wait,
a big
can I
driver.
Just, can I just, does that actually say $129 a pound?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so, why?
Well, do you see all those white specks?
Yeah.
That's intermuscular fat, or marbling, we call it.
Yeah.
And that is not easy to obtain. So that's when you have fat running right through the muscle. And
so
as you can see this.
Wagyu New York strip, right? Is that what we're talking about here?
It is, yeah.
Right.
That's Blackmore's Ranch from Australia.
And that makes it $129 a pound.
Mate, when you put it in your mouth, you would pay double that for it.
Well, clearly, I'm going to have to come here for dinner because, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we have reasonable stuff too. You know, this is obviously an extremely premium product.
Right.
But we have grass-fed beef and grain-fed beef that's grown domestically.
Right. Well, it gets me back to the, you're looking for a certain clientele to come in the door.
Yeah, very much so. It's, you know, we can't compete with supermarkets, so we don't try.
Right.
We make sure that we have the very best of what we can source from, as you know, as you see, from the Wagyu from Australia to across the country.
Do you have a meat buyer, I guess? Or is it you guys?
It's us. I mean,
when you go back to Australia, do you go and get the beef?
Yeah. We have relationships direct with the ranchers. I usually go to most of the farms that we buy from.
So riddle me this. Are you a chef or are you an entrepreneur?
I'm a chef.
Are you?
Yeah.
Except you're sourcing your own materials and doing
that's a part of being a chef. You've got to know where your ingredients come from, whether it's meat or vegetables or where your dry goods come from. You know, you have to have really good relationships, and I think that's the most important part.
So what's it like running this place? As you sit here, right, you're the guy nominally in charge of the business side of the house, right?
Yeah, it's challenging. It's a lot of fun. We roll around 60 staff at any one point in time in here, so between the butchers and two bars and events and kitchen and front of house, there's a lot going on at all times. So.
How tough is it for you to find people to be the servers and the front of the house folks?
Yeah, it's tough. It's Hollywood's, LA, I think, is an interesting sort of demographic in that there's a lot of actors and writers and producers and whatnot, but they all end up working here.
Was it this place or Maud where you had the no actors rule?
Oh, that was at Maud.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't. Look, we love actors. My wife's an actor. I can't have a no actors rule. We wanted to hire floor staff that were dedicated to the art of hospitality, not the art of being an actor. So, you know, we tried not to employ people that it was an in-between job for. So that's the joke was we didn't employ actors. But, you know, the truth is we're open to whoever it is that sees this as their career and really wants to, you know, wants to do great things in a hospitality sense.
For our director of operations, he has a no headshot policy. So if your headshot's on your resume, it's very hard to get in the door.
Yeah, that's the beauty of your radio, man. You don't have to deal with headshots.
That's true.
What is it that people don't understand about the restaurant business? Because you come in here and it's a bustling, great place, looks like a lot of fun, but clearly you guys are killing yourselves in the back of the house.
Oh, it's a lot of work, yeah, for sure. We start our days at 9 o'clock in the morning most days, and most people don't come for dinner until 7 or 8 o'clock at night. So we've had a full day before the evening even really starts. Same with the front of house. You know, there's a variety, and these guys are here sometimes until 2 o'clock in the morning. So, it's a scrappy industry, but I love it. You know, it's sort of it's either in
Why
your
you
blood or
it?
It's not. Look, I think that it's always just an inch from a disaster. And that's kind of exciting.
Doesn't sound like a great business model, though.
But you're never bored. You're never bored.
Yeah.
It's true. You look at your watch and you're always thinking, is that the time already? You never think, oh, God, today's taking forever.
Yeah.
The days just flash by you, and that's I think that's good if you can enjoy your work.
It's crazy cool stuff.
You look like you're in a meat coma. You only had one slice of
salami. I am a meat guy. That's, you know, a good charcuterie plate is my go-to. You've been really generous.
Unreal,
I appreciate
mate. Nice to meet you.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Chef Curtis Stone at his second LA restaurant, Gwen, right before dinner service a couple of weeks ago.
Christmas final note on the way out today, the sad, sad saga of the cargo ship Peak Pegasus. It had soybeans on board, American soybeans, approaching yesterday the Chinese port of Dalian. Regular listeners to this program will remember that soybeans were on China's list of American imports they had threatened to hit with tariffs if U.S. tariffs went into effect as they did last night. So there had been an internet watch party of sorts tracking Peak Pegasus the past couple of days, watching it pick up speed as it tried to beat Beijing's tariffs. Well, sorry to say, missed it by this much. It was about 25 miles off Dalian when time ran out. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 0.4% today, 99 points. NASDAQ climbed 1.3%, about 101 points. S&P 500, 0.8% to the good, 23 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.